Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and it's great to be here with my co-host, Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Thursday, May 26, 2022. And I'm not going to say hello, Dave, because, again, we have technical difficulties. There's just something with where he's at in Pennsylvania, that their internet, their connections just, and I do believe he has Comcast, so I don't know, either that or Verizon, and, they have issues with, booting on and getting on at the top of the hour, so hopefully he'll be here soon. So in the meantime, you have me. And we're gonna go to the gold prices today. And, you know, we're seeing pressure again today on gold. However, it had a nice comeback, down $1.70 at $1,853. This is the New York spot price after market. Silver was up 4 pennies at 22.11. Platinum was up $2 at 958. Palladium was up 14, 2,112. And most of the recovery in the precious metals market was really in late afternoon, you know, so, kind of interesting to see that, as we have the U.S. dollar had a reversal today. It was 0.30 to the downside, 101.79. Crude oil, $3.59 positive, 113.92. And, you know, we have the Dow rising for the fifth straight day. And the S&P and the NASDAQ, they're trying to snap their 7-week losing streak. But, hey, the Dow was up 516 points, 32,637. The S&P up 80, 4,057, almost 2%. The NASDAQ was up a little over 2.5%, 305 points, 11,740. And, you know, I'm reading about, you know, or listening to the news talking about the Memorial Day holiday, and that today is actually the busiest traveling day for the weekend. So my thoughts are, yeah, there's no investors out there. It's a, you know, nobody's working today. You know, we turn a 3-day weekend into a 4- and 5-day weekend now. So, I'm sure there was light trading out there. If I have time, I'll look up to see what trading was today, but I'm sure it was light, and I think that's why you're seeing these big increases on the various things. And I do hear some tapping in the background, so that means David is with us.
Yeah, boy. yes, he is. Hello, Melody.
Hello.
And, hello, world. Technical difficulties again on my end. My apologies for that.
Well, no need for apology. It's welcome to the new world of, you know, you would think that as much as they push technology on us and everything else, that they could actually do a better job in keeping the connections going. But, hey, it's just another sign that the infrastructure is not there to support better connections. But anyway, I was talking about probably a lot of light trading today, which gave us, you know, higher numbers in the markets and so forth. We'll talk a little bit about what the Fed said. That might have had a little bit of impact, but I'm sure we can reverse what he had to say. And it's really not a good thing. Shanghai was positive in the Asian markets. Europe was all positive. So things are good in the world. Bonds, 10-year yield shows unchanged at 2.74%, and I'm just going to pull up oil again. Natural gas, it was down a little bit, but it's still 8.78. Brent was up 2.83%, and WTI was actually up 3.2%. So a huge move in the oil prices today. And so it's, as I said, we're going to talk a little bit about our economy to get started, Dave. And, you know, the GDP, the first quarter, declined. Mm-hmm. it declined to start 2022. It was worse than what they had expected, of course, and they're never going to tell you the truth. Declined 1.5% annual pace. Now, this is all according to the Commerce Department's Bureau of Economic Analysis. Now, that was worse than the 1.3 estimate. And a write-down from initially reported 1.4%. Downward revisions for both private inventory and residential investment offset an upward change in consumer spending. And a swelling trade deficit also subtracted from the GDP. This is the worst quarter since 2020, when they shut up and closed down everything during well, the beginning of the COVID crisis. The U.S. had fallen into recession. The GDP had plummeted 31%, spurred by a nationwide shutdown to battle COVID. But, gee, Dave, remember, you know, we plummeted that amount, the GDP, and yet we were only in a recession for, what, 2 months? So, yay.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, okay. Well, I got a bridge in Florida for you, too.
The survey shows that a median expectation of economists is for 3.3% growth the quarter we're in now, although the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now tracker points to a more subdued 1.8% pace. Scott Hoyt at Moody's Analytics said this year's will be mixed. Decline should not be repeated, he said, but growth will not match what has been seen since the economy began reopening. The Federal Reserve seemingly totally focused on bringing inflation back down. He added that recession risks are uncomfortably high, although perhaps more for next year than this. So we shall see. Consumer spending, measured by the Personal Consumptions Expenditure Index, increased 3.1%, better than its first estimate of 2.7%. Coming as labor market continues to be strong and wages increase rapidly, though way below the rate of inflation, Melody.
You know, spending was so good at 3.1%, and we're a consumer economy of 70%. Wouldn't you think, I mean, which number, wouldn't that number be lower considering we have the drop of the 1.5% GDP?
Hard to say. I'm not quite sure that there's.
Or does it take like a 6% consumer spending in order to get a better GDP and at a 3.1%? That's what brings us the 1.5.
Yeah. Good question.
But anyway, the government says our jobless claims edged a little bit lower. And this is the number of Americans collecting unemployment benefits. Applications fell by 8,000 to 210,000 for the week ending May 21st. 4-week average for claims, which kind of smooths out some of that volatility, ticked up from the previous week to 206,000. So the total number of Americans collecting jobless benefits for the week ending the 14th rose 31,000 from the previous week. So, you know, still a historically strong job market out there. And for those who are working, and let's see, anything else that we would like to add to that? I know this one kind of always ruffles your feathers.
When, you know, again, you see articles talking about the lowest unemployment in five decades at 3.6%, which is totally bogus. Mm-hmm. It's a minimum of 6.9%. That's the Labor Department's U6 rate, which includes short-term discouraged workers and those working part-time, even though they would like a full-time job. So you three, called the headline unemployment rate is a farce. And it, yes, it is a pet peeve of mine. I just don't get how everyone continues to really confuse the public and just cloud their own judgment with numbers that are grossly understated.
And you know, I mean, at a 6.9% with $5 gasoline, that'd bring this economy to a screeching halt. It's all about, you know, making you feel good to keep this economy going. I mean, just like yesterday, the durable goods number came out, and, you know, you read the headline, oh, the durable goods headlines come out, and they say, you know, the number is, you know, this one and up, and they make it believe like it's a stronger number, but it isn't. It went down. And so it's, you know, it's the way the media works anymore. It's all about headlines, and that's all the further people usually will read is the headline and say, oh, wow, durable goods are up, so good. No, not so much. Fed revises PCE index for its preferred inflation gauge, the personal consumption expenditure index, to 4.3% for this year before falling to 2.5% next year. Okay, of course they're going to do that. Members of the FOMC say they aren't unduly worried about economic growth, not at all, and expect it to advance at a solid pace over the remainder of the year. What do they look at in order to think that we're going to have this economic growth over the remainder of the year? And this is what they're saying to the minutes of their latest meeting. They met earlier this month. Economic data has taken a step backward. The Fed Atlantic President Rafael Bostic suggested it may make sense to pause on rates in September. Told you. But economists note that the likelihood of such a pause will only be on the table if inflation falls more than expected over the summer. I don't think they're looking to see inflation fall that will make them react. What's going to make them react is if the stock market falls. That's what makes them react. The FOMC is expected to raise interest rates by 0.5 point in June and July. That'll boost the policy rate to 1.75% to 2% target range. So by September, the Fed will also be shrinking its balance sheet by $95 billion a month, which is the second tool that officials are trying to use to tighten policy, Dave.
Well, therein, I believe, lies our future. Excuse me. Or perhaps the future of the U.S. stock markets. I'll talk about the Fed owning an astounding nearly 40% of 10 to 30 year treasuries right now. And I think as they start to unwind, that a couple of different things will happen, which we'll talk about more in the third segment. But when they're talking about by September starting a $95 billion a month shrinking of its balance sheet, that along with at least one, if not two more 50 basis point increases in the Fed funds rate by then, people who are talking about a recession next year, I think, are going to have a little bit of pie in their face. That might not be happening by September or even October by federal definition standards. But November, December, look out, ladies and gentlemen. Be very cautious with your disposable income in the coming months.
Well, we're looking forward to that report in the last segment of the program today.
It's an eye opener.
Mm-hmm. But they could not do anything. They could recall all of their what they want to do, but then everything else just catches up and takes away. So again, they're between a rock and a hard place. There's nothing they can do. They're going to be darned if they do and darned if they don't. And so,
well, I'm afraid that with their having been behind the eight ball from the outset this year and having waited too long to start readjusting or manipulating the markets, depending on how you want to characterize it, I just think it's going to end up being a little bit too much, too little, too late, until it's too much, too late, and that'll send us into a recession.
I'd like to know what information the Fed follows to, of course, they create the information, so to where they actually, when they decide to do this and that. They listen to J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, you know, they listen to Wall Street.
Yeah, and they, I mean, for better or for worse, they do have a pretty large staff of economists and analysts and computer modeling experts, and they have some pretty I almost said sophisticated. They have complex computer models that estimate all sorts of economic variables and how they impact primarily their preferred PCE index and employment, and that in large part, I think, from a technical vantage point anyway, is a good part of I think their analysis. Now, what individual FOMC members might do in lieu of or in addition to that, like you mentioned, talking to the too big to fail banks, and multinational corporations, other Wall Street companies, and perhaps some top government officials. I mean, who knows? But the Fed's track record in the long run has not been all that good. And I expect this time, well, I don't expect, I just fear that their track record suggests that this could not be it will be a dark time for the Fed.
And it's a dark time for us because we're heading into a break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk Radio. TruthAndEducationRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. And I think we're finishing up the some of the information. What did you want to talk about, Dave?
The budget deficits.
The budget deficit. Okay, let's go in there. Well, the Congressional Budget Office said yesterday that the government's budget deficit is supposed to shrink this year before skyrocketing in the years ahead. So I guess we got a little bit of a reprieve, but it's only temporary. And again, I mean, it's just based on the huge spending programs that was created during 2020 and 2021 for the pandemic. And that's going to stop, and tax revenues increase. That means your taxes are going up. I don't know how, how and where the tax revenues are increasing at, Dave.
Income taxes.
Well, that's a good thing. Less money in people's pockets. But
people are getting higher pay raises. And so
and inflation is going up. And inflation is going up. So they're still in a hole. So it ain't helping the American people at all. The budget deficit is supposed to shrink a trillion dollars this year, from $2.8 trillion in 2021. Well, I'll have to wait till the end of the year to see again. But then it's supposed to rise more than $2 trillion as we go forward in 2032. I'll guarantee it's going to rise more than $2 trillion before 2032. And usually the CBO is usually, I don't know, they're usually not so far out in their predictions and so forth. I mean, 2032 is a ways away.
Well, remember, too, that their forecasts assume current policies remaining in place. And so, you know, we know current policies will not remain in place. There'll be new programs. There'll be other, you know, if there's a recession, tax revenues will fall significantly. And, you know, so the $2 trillion should be taken, not necessarily the grain of salt, but certainly with the, you know, the realization that it's likely to be a lot higher.
But it's going to be a lot higher. I mean, when you look at what, if we go into war, recessions, all kinds of things. But what else would you like to add to that, Dave?
Well, long-term debt, which is now hovering around 100% of GDP. That's debt held by the public, not gross public debt, is expected, again, in line with that temporary decrease in the annual budget deficit, to dip to 96% by the beginning of October, then is expected to reach 110% of GDP by the end of the decade. And then soar. I mean, earlier this year, CBO's longer-term debt projections had us in certain scenarios being almost twice GDP you know, depending on the scenario, anywhere from, I think, 150% to over 200%. I mean, that's just nuts. Among other things, what it will mean is that more and more of government spending, a higher proportion of the annual budget will go to pay interest on that debt. And that does a number of things. I mean, theoretically, you'd think it might result in forced choices to cut spending in other areas, although that almost never happens. Everything just continues to go up. And then the revenue side, again, is so dependent on the economy and to some extent tax policy, but that's what I think will drive the long-term debt number much higher than what it is projected to be under current policy.
Yeah, we know government has to spend. Government likes inflation because the amount of debt that they have. So, you know, they just have to keep – it's not going to change. It has to be done. Or the whole thing falls apart, and I don't think they're going to, they have to keep the system floating. And, we talked about, I mentioned this, I think it was on the other day, the program where I said it was amazing to see the amount of people in Ocean City this past weekend. So the higher gas prices is not putting a damper on their vacations. There was a huge number of folks, you know, in the area. So there was a report out by Morgan Stanley. Can you take the...
Oh, yeah. Melody was just about ready to say that analysts are too big to fail. Morgan Stanley wrote in a recent report that high inflation, especially with respect to gasoline, is acting as a regressive tax on consumers. And they're feeling the burden of it. That essentially means that lower income folks are getting the brunt of rising prices. The lower income folks in this case are people that are households that make less than the median household income of $68,000 a year. Last week, we talked about Walmart, America's largest retailer, announcing drastically lower than expected earnings in the first quarter, despite what appeared to be solid sales numbers. Just pricing and spending. I mean, executives there spotlighted the fact that low-income customers were switching from name-brand lunch meats, deli items, dairy, all other kinds of products, to generics, to Walmart-branded items as prices have surged. We also know that credit card debt is growing at its fastest rate in a number of years. It's according to the New York Fed, anyway. More consumers are looking to cover these rising costs, including things like food and gasoline, putting on their charge cards, and the increasing interest rates for those not paying off their monthly balances in full are generating a windfall for these bank card issuers. Plus, a number of consumers are starting to fall behind on monthly payments for their car loans. The share of subprime auto loans, those with high rates made people with less than stellar credit scores that were more than 60 days late, has increased in each of the last 8 months. Not a good trend. Now sits at 8.5%. Economists say there's little evidence so far this year anyway that it's going to get a whole lot better anytime soon. So we will see. I mean, I guess it's bottom line, pandemic era programs like the child tax credit increase, which gave lower income Americans more financial breathing room, are gone. So wages and employment are going to be even more important in the months ahead. Excuse me.
I'm back.
Hey.
Hey, sorry about that.
Oh, no worries, no worries. We just finished up there, and looks like we were segueing into, the concentration of big corporations, how that's contributing to inflation.
And it's true. You have these the multinational corporate concentration, and there's just a few companies that make up an entire industry, and it contributes to inflation. This was from a new paper out of the Boston Fed, and this is what they have found, that there's a debate over what is exactly is causing record inflation in the U.S. Well, let me tell you. It's our dollar. It's our monetary policy, guys. Come on. Come on. The more you spend, the weaker you're... I mean, anyway, they can't say that. But this is what they're saying. There was an argument of lawmakers and economists who are saying companies are taking advantage of this moment to push prices up. But you know what? It might be true that they might be, but you know what? Everything, it costs them more too. Their living expenses are higher. Everybody's things are higher. So they have to adjust and increase prices. And I guess we just don't know what you do or what is the line from usury and, you know, to where you're offsetting your increased costs, because it's always going to be passed down. So what's the red line that determines what is something that they're taking advantage of?
Yeah, well, we don't have the specifics from this report yet, but the authors do conclude that in these more concentrated industries, again, specified that companies passed almost a quarter more of increased costs onto consumers. And the authors say that their estimates are conservative because of the amount of, I guess, corporate consolidations having increased so sharply since 2019. In fact, they say the U.S. economy is at least 50% more concentrated today than in 2005. So anyway, not everyone agrees with that. We've got folks, economists like Larry Summers, argue that inflation has more to do with supply chains, pandemic-driven demand, for example, and increasing wages for workers as the economy rebounds from pandemic lows. So as the Boston Fed releases the details, we'll be sure to let you know how we think they're wrong.
Yeah, Larry Summers should know better, but he's getting old. He's getting old. And he has to say where he gets paid, just like them all, just like they all do. Penny home sales slipped in April as contract activity decreased for the sixth straight consecutive month. This is out of the National Association of Realtors. Only the Midwest saw signings increase month over month, while the other three major regions reported declines. Let's see what else is good in there. The Pending Home Sales Index, a forward-looking indicator of home sales based on contract signings, slid almost 4%. In April. Year-over-year transactions fell 9.1%. And an index of 100 is equal to the level of contract activity in 2001. So Larry Young, he's a realtor's chief economist, says the pending contracts are telling as they better reflect a timelier impact from higher mortgage rates than do closings. The latest contract signings are at the slowest pace in nearly a decade. It's huge. The escalating mortgage rates have bumped up the cost of purchasing a home by more than 25% from a year ago. while steeper home prices are adding another 15% to that figure. That's 40%, Dave.
Indeed. Well, you know, Young goes on to say home sales in 2022 are expected to be down nearly 10%. And if mortgage rates climb to 6%, which I'm afraid is quite conceivable, then Young sees the sales activity falling by another 15%. The housing bubble is on the verge of bursting, Melody.
That's you know, and you know what? I've actually seen more homes, if you look around, building in places that you don't normally see. I mean, I was, you know, so I guess they're trying to get it done before they go any higher. So there is a mad dash, but that's those numbers kind of surprise me. 40%. Wow. Here's an interesting demand for the Federal Reserve's reverse repurchase agreement program. It has surged in the last couple of weeks at the Treasury Department's reduced supply of short-term bills that left investors just a few options to park their excess cash. Reverse repos, they are conducted by the New York Fed's open market trading desk. In a reverse repo, market participants lend cash to the Fed, and it's usually overnight at an interest rate of 80 basis points. And that's in exchange for treasuries or some other government security, and always with a promise to buy them back. Analysts say that's a function of two things. First, the extreme high demand for front-end assets. Second, the amount of treasuries outstanding has continued to decline as the Treasury has cut back supply because of tax collections. The Fed reverse repo window attracted a record $2.045 trillion on Monday as these financial institutions, they just continue to flood the facility with liquidity in exchange for Treasury collateral. It was one of a string of record highs. That's a lot, Dave.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Now, Tuesday, the reverse repo volume did slip to $1.99 trillion. And that was a result of cash flows from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
All right, we're heading into the second break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CommonSenseTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's where you can reach Melody this segment as she's taking care of clients. So even when everyday workers, rank and file workers, win their biggest raises in decades, they look minuscule right now compared to what their CEOs have been getting. Typical compensation package for chief executives who run S&P 500 companies soared over 17% last year to a mere median of $14.5 million. That gain quadruples the 4.4% increase in wages and benefits netted by everyday private sector workers through last year and was the fastest on record going back to 2001. The raises for many rank and file workers also failed to keep up with inflation, which reached 7% by the end of last year and, of course, now exceeds 8%. CEO pay took off as stock prices and profits rebounded sharply as the economy was, well, coming out of its 2020 recession because of a CEO's compensation being tied to that kind of performance, their pay packages ballooned. And many of the most eye-popping packages, like Expedia Group's valued at $296 million and J.P. Morgan Chase's $84.4 million, boards gave particularly big grants of stock or stock options to recently appointed CEOs. Now, often those CEOs can't cash in on those stock options for, well, years, sometimes 5 years, sometimes longer, sometimes not ever, unless the company meets certain performance targets. But companies are still required to disclose estimates for how much they're worth. Only about a quarter of the typical pay package for all S&P CEOs last year came as actual cash that they could pocket. Nevertheless, the chasm in pay between CEOs and their rank and file workers they oversee keeps getting wider and wider. At half the companies in this year's pay survey, it would take the worker at the middle of the company's pay scale 186 years to make what their CEO did last year. That's an increase of 20 years from 2020. At Walmart, for example, the company said its median associate made $25,335 in compensation last year, a lot of them part-timers. That means half its workers made more and half made less. Well, that's up 21% from a year earlier and came as the company's average hourly wage for associates rose from $14.50 in January 2021 to over $17 today. That increase was bigger than the raise CEO Doug McMillon got on a percentage basis, but his mere 13.7% raise netted him a total package valued at $25.7 million. Not surprisingly, anger growing over these imbalances. Surveys suggest Americans across political parties see CEO pay as too high. Some investors are pushing back. On one hand, workers are trying to organize unions across the country, and the Great Resignation, as it's called, has emboldened millions to quit to find better jobs or higher paying jobs elsewhere. The federal government counted more than 4 million quits in April 2021. First time that happened at that level. The number since top 4.5 million twice. Sarah Anderson at the Institute for Policy Studies says that's going to add a huge cost to corporate bottom lines to have those kinds of turnover rates. They should be thinking about what kind of message they're sending to those people about whether they're really valued in their jobs. Anderson added, when the guy in the corner office is making several hundred, if not thousands of times more, that's sending a demoralizing message. Now, gains for CEO pay had been slowing in recent years, with the median rise easing from 8.5% in 2017 to 4% in 2019. Ticked back up to 5% in 2020. Obviously a complicated year because the pandemic shut down the economy and profits at many companies simply tanked. For 2020, many companies tweaked the intricate formulas they created to determine their CEO pay. That made up for losses caused by the pandemic, something many boards said was an extraordinary event outside the CEO's control. Then came 2021. Thanks to a reopened economy and all this pent-up demand, super low interest rates and other factors, stock prices soared, the S&P 500 jumped 27%, set records throughout the years. Earnings per share soared almost 50%. Dan Ladin, who is with Compensation Advisory Partners, a consulting firm that works with corporate boards, added, throughout the year, CEOs had to navigate backed up supply chains and shortages of chips and other key materials that impacted businesses across industries. And all of that led to a desire to really reward executives. Because the financial performance was there, and the view was that management teams were exceptional in navigating the situation and delivering results. So last year's 17% leap for median pay of the S&P 500 CEOs was the biggest since a 24% surge in 2010 comp packages. I mean, look at Mary Barra, CEO of GM. Her industry was particularly hard hit by the shortage of computer chips during the pandemic. That hammered auto production. Even so, GM's board highlighted how the company still delivered record earnings before interest, taxes, and some other items. The automaker also accelerated development of its electric vehicles. Those are two of the factors that influences Barra's pay, and her comp climbed 25% to $29.1 million. Dave Green, who's a hot metal driver at a GM facility in Indiana, said, I would hope that the corporation making record profits would recognize that the workers doing the work are the ones generating the revenue. Well, we're just trying to get by. Green cited in particular temporary workers making about $16 an hour who have to work years before being hired as full-time employees at GM and just don't get many opportunities for days off in the meantime. And closer to the top of the rankings for CEO pay last year was J.P. Morgan's Chase All-American good guy Jamie Dimon, whose compensation package valued at $84.4 mil was the fifth highest at least one of the surveys. That was an increase of 167% from a year earlier, and most of it came from an award of stock options valued at about $53 million. Chase's board said it provided the options because of its desire for Dimon, who's now 66, to keep leading the company for significantly more years. It also said the options weren't part of his regular annual compensation, that he must wait at least 5 years to begin exercising them. Even so, only 31% of investors at J.P. Morgan Chase's annual meeting of shareholders recently gave a thumbs up on Dimon's pay package. I was one of the 69% who said no. Unfortunately, the overwhelming vote is only advisory, though, and doesn't force the company to make changes. 84.4 mil, not bad for a CEO of a too-big-to-fail bank that's been indicted 5 times this century alone for felony financial misdeeds, including manipulating the precious metals treasury markets. Well, if you saw this, Abbott Nutrition today apologized for the baby formula shortage, while the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, provided a timeline for its inspection that resulted in a temporary shutdown and massive shortages of infant formula across the country. Lawmakers at a congressional hearing yesterday called for more completion for manufacturers to prevent future supply disruptions of this vital product. As we now know, the FDA learned last September of a serious infection of an infant who consumed baby formula made at Abbott's Sturgis, Michigan plant, according to the FDA. After another case was reported on December 1st, the FDA scheduled an inspection for December 30th, almost a full month later. The agency ended up delaying that inspection another month until January 31st, after Abbott reported a dozen COVID cases among its employees there. Then the FDA temporarily shut down the plant in February. The eventual inspection found serious cracks in key equipment, water leaks and condensation in areas where dry powdered formula was produced. The FDA now is expected to allow Abbott to reopen the Sturgis factory as early as next week after the company makes or finishes a round of improvements. And last today, as we talked about, referred to anyway, last segment, on Tuesday, New York Fed's trading desk released its annual report showing what it was up to in 2021. New York Fed is the only one of the Fed's 12 regional Fed banks to have a trading desk operation with speed dials to Wall Street's largest trading houses. So it's always interesting to read the official version of what's been happening there. Although, as Pam and Russ Martins write in today's Wall Street on Parade, the report is a deeply sanitized version of facts on the ground. For example, there's nothing in the report to indicate that the New York Fed has opened a second trading desk down the street from the futures exchange in Chicago. However, there is one paragraph in the newly released report that takes your breath away. It reveals that the New York Fed's trading operation, officially called SOMA, the System Open Market Account, currently owns 38% of all outstanding treasuries with 10 to 30 years remaining until maturity. Now, there are multiple reasons why the Martins say that detail should take your breath away. First of all, as they point out, the U.S. Treasury market is massive, $22.6 trillion at the end of 2021. That any one entity controls such a big chunk of the market is already deeply concerning. The same report showed that the New York Fed's trading desk owned 25% of all maturities of outstanding Treasury debt. The New York Fed's trading desk owning 38% of the 10 to 30-year Treasuries is also alarming because that's the maturity range that has a dramatic impact on the interest rate of, yes, the popular 30-year fixed residential mortgage rate. It means that the New York Fed's gobbling up of these 10-year Treasury notes and 30-year Treasury bonds, the tune of 38% of the market, has created artificial demand for these instruments that would not otherwise exist. That, in turn, means that mortgage rates have been artificially held much lower than they otherwise would have been. Even more alarming, the Martins say, it means that the recent announcements by the Fed that it will be reducing its purchase of treasuries and shrinking its balance sheet by reducing the amount of principal payments that are rolled into new treasury securities is going to have a dramatic impact on residential mortgage rates. 30-year fixed mortgage has already spiked from an average of less than 3% to 5.25% as of May 19th. That's an increase of over 75%. a dramatic spike in the rate over a period of just 7 months has priced many first-time home buyers out of the market. And just wait until it hits six. The Fed calls its purchases of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities as quantitative easing, QE. Well, Fed embarked on three rounds of QE between 2008 and 2012 to stimulate the economy and get it back on sound footing after Wall Street crashed the economy with its derivatives and subprime debt bombs in 2008. And when the repo market blew up in the fall of 2019, the New York Fed cranked up its QE operations again and ramped them up further when the pandemic hit in 2020. In June of that year, the Fed began purchasing $120 billion in debt securities each month. That's a larger amount than during the Great Recession. Fed's balance sheet has grown from $924 billion at the end of 2007, prior to the financial crash of 2008, to $8.99 trillion last week. Yes, something is rotten in Denmark, ladies and gentlemen. And you know what? Thanks to the Fed, it's about to get worse before it gets better. That's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday after the Memorial Day weekend. Melody will be back tomorrow with Butch. Also, be on the lookout of our weekly blog and your email inboxes in the AM. Thanks always to our engineer, Todd, and to you for tuning in to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Have a great evening. Please be safe out there. Bye-bye. I wouldn't have to work at all. I'd fool around and have a ball.
Broadcasting to the U.S. and around the world by way of Clear Digital Audio, 22,500 miles above the